Welcome to this week's edition of Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of the news from the grassroots, news overlooked by the corporate media. On today's show, an investigation of taser use by police in Allegheny County. The America's Army video game recruits children while generating profits for private software companies. A special segment of $2.3 million and rising. A local activist describes the police repression faced by protesters at the Republican National Convention. A flotilla of kayaks challenge the world's largest pipe-laying ship off the west coast of Ireland, and more in our local and global headlines.
Rust Belt Radio is broadcast live from WRCT Studios every Monday at 6 p.m. on 88.3 FM in Pittsburgh, and the program airs again on WRCT every Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. We can also be heard weekly on the following stations: WPTS Pittsburgh, 92.1 FM, WNJR Washington, 91.7 FM, WVJW Benwood, 94.1 FM, WIUP Indiana, 90.1 FM, and we're also available on the internet, both on WRCT's live web stream at wrct.org, and for download, stream, or podcast from our website at radio.indypgh.org. This show kicks off our new fall season of Rust Belt Radio, and we'd like to thank listeners for tuning in once again. We turn now to local stories.
In July of 1997, the Duron Cox was put on trial for the shooting of Brian Roberts in the Pittsburgh neighborhood of Homewood. The questionable eyewitness testimony of Rasheed Smith gave Cox a life sentence without the possibility of parole at the age of 18. For this week's $2.3 million and rising, Fed Up spoke with Rick Morris, who is the executive director of the Duron Cox Legal Defense Fund, about the grave mishandling of Cox's case that landed him in prison, despite the very convincing evidence that he is innocent. First, Morris gave some background information on the case.
The background on the case was that Brian Roberts had been busted about 2 weeks earlier with a fellow named Roland Cephas. And at that time, Brian had told the police, those aren't my drugs, it's not my gun, they all belong to Roland. So Brian walked away and Roland ended up getting locked up. A couple days before Brian was murdered, and this was stated by a very close friend of his who was interviewed very shortly after the murder by police, this scenario was relayed to police that Brian had told this woman, Roland's after me and I think I might get killed. Well, the next day he did in fact get killed, and that's kind of the background to the case. Now, there were three witnesses at the scene of the crime. Two of them were identified in police reports. Duron Cox's trial attorney, Sid Sokalski, never interviewed any of these witnesses. Mr. Sokalski claimed in a hearing in 2004 that he attempted to find Mr. Shelton, one of the witnesses, through the use of his investigator, his private investigator that he suggested he hired. However, the strange part about that is Mr. Shelton, who had a reputation for being a history of being incarcerated, was locked up in Allegheny County Jail, the same place where Duron was locked up while he was awaiting trial. All Mr. Sokalski had to do was go to the guard and ask to speak to him if he was indeed looking for Mr. Shelton. So the notion that he had a private eye out looking for this guy who had a long rap sheet, unless he hired Ace Ventura, it's hard to believe that he actually had a private eye looking for him, or that Mr. Sokalski himself made a serious effort to find Mr. Shelton, and he never did interview him or any of the other witnesses. The case has been on appeal through multiple levels of courts since then, and we've had three eyewitnesses. The two identified in police reports have come forward and stated that Duron was not the shooter. They've told me that Duron was not even present. A third eyewitness has said not only was Duron not present, he identified the shooter as Roland, which is consistent with the motive that the police were given. Roland, it turned out, had lawyered up immediately after when the cops came to interview him. It was a brief interview, and he denied having any involvement. He went home. So there's the big picture of it.
Now Morris explains the appeals process and frustrations encountered along the way.
Well, the appeals process, it sort of starts with let's ignore the large elephant in the room, which is the fact that Sid Sokalski really did very little, if anything, to defend Duron Cox. So the ineffectiveness of counsel, once the judges decided not to acknowledge that counsel was ineffective, that opens up numerous legal loopholes to refute and to deny the admission of a number of pieces of evidence. You know, we say that this should be admitted, and they say, well, you know, the original trial attorney didn't admit it, and he wasn't found ineffective, so, you know, we're right. But when you look at the preponderance of evidence, if you just take the whole, you know, big picture, what I described, three witnesses have come forward and said that, you know, Duran didn't do it, he wasn't present, and they've all stated that Rashi was not present. The way I found out that Rashi, I mean, people, I think that information comes through, like, brilliant legal work, getting people on the stand and, you know, interrogating them until you get them to say what you want. I was standing on the steps of this court, and I had just met this, you know, witness that morning, and I was just making conversation with him, and I said, so, you know, you were standing here, Orande was standing here, and, you know, Rashi was standing. Where was he standing? And the guy looked at me and said, Rashi? Rashi wasn't there. And for 4 years, we had been working on the assumption that Rashi was there and just mistakenly identified Duran as the shooter. Well, then we did some extra research, and we found another person who stated in an affidavit that he was with Rashi two blocks away. What happened was the murder occurred, the shooter took off, people started to take off, and one of the people that was present ran down to this house where there was a party, which is where Rashi was. So they were about the first people on the scene. They arrived a minute later, and Brian was there dying, and Rashi was close friends with Brian, and he cradled him. 5 weeks later, Rashi gets taken in for an unrelated crime and basically made a deal that, look, if you can help us with this crime, we'll give you a break on your situation. We'll write a letter to the judge. And so Rashi threw Duran's name. I mean, when you examine it, it's not that complicated. Okay, the guy who did it just killed someone for snitching. So he had two choices. I can throw in Roland's name, who's already shot one guy for snitching. Probably not a good idea. Or you know what? Maybe I'll throw in the name of the neighborhood honor student. Now, I'm not going to say that Duran was a perfect angel, never did anything wrong. He'd been busted for selling drugs a couple times in the area. This crime took place in one of the worst areas of Pittsburgh. So Duran did hang around with these people and was seen in that area. But both times Duran had been busted, he did not have a gun on him. He had a reputation for not carrying a gun. He just wasn't involved in that sort of higher-level gangster activity. And, you know, so it was easy to throw his name in because he was not a threat because he was, like I say, the neighborhood honor student, wasn't known to carry a gun, and the guy was looking to get a break on his situation. As I said, his testimony ended up completely contradicting the scientific evidence, and later on we learned why, because he wasn't actually there, so he didn't know what happened. If you had told me 10 years ago I'd still be working on this case, I would have thought you were kidding. Because there are a number of things that were raised that were simply not acted on in a timely manner. And one of the things we're fighting right now is just a goofy legal technicality. I mentioned that a witness came forward and the witness said, I will, you know, this is what I saw, and Roland Cephas did it. And we had his affidavit, and I had a conference call between three of the top lawyers, two top lawyers in Pennsylvania, and attorney John Knorr. And at the end of the conference call, and this is backed up even by an internal memo I have from John Knorr's files, Mr. Knorr says, I will file this by October 25th, which would eliminate any gray area on beating the deadline. I believe it's October 25th, 2006. He files it November 2nd, 2 days past the possible deadline. And so now, instead of just going into courts and you know, arguing over the validity of the evidence, the DA spends their time using the legal loophole that this is 2 days late. And, you know, because of that, conceivably, a young man could spend the rest of his life in prison and never be allowed to have the evidence brought to court. And it's most of it's evidence that should have been dug up in the very first place.
We'll end with things that local listeners can do to bring real justice to Cox and our Pennsylvania courts.
It's important for people to, you know, reach out and write to District Attorney Stephen Zappala in Allegheny County. In a larger issue, there's a very important piece of activity that's going on here that was sponsored by Senator Greenleaf here in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. And the idea, once someone is put away, once someone has a prison number, you know, it's hard to get sympathy for them. It's just sort of like the scarlet letter. And so, you know, if you go out and you're trying to raise money for, you know, medical disabilities, it's a lot easier to get sympathy. And the idea that people are wrongfully convicted, you know, people tend to believe in the justice system. I certainly did much more before I got involved. But there's a frightening number of people who are convicted every day. As you well know, there's 2.3 million people in jails now, and it's rising. People are convicted every day for no good reason. And there are clear causes to it. But a committee has been appointed here in Pennsylvania to study these issues. And in North Carolina, they appointed a committee, and at the end of their investigation, they set up an ongoing committee that would listen to cases and review them to see if they deserved. It's basically set out almost outside the justice system or in addition to the appeals process. If a case just sort of screams out for review, then this committee has the power to send it to the Supreme Court, who then supports a three-judge panel that will review the case, and wrongful convictions get overturned through that process. And I think it's necessary in Pennsylvania and a lot of other states. So it wouldn't hurt to also write to Senator Greenleaf and his committee, his assistant, Greg Warner, and let them know that you'd like to see a review panel appointed to look at cases of wrongful conviction. And in this particular case, there's five, major causes for wrongful conviction that include false confessions in cases of wrongful conviction. And this is a very difficult thing for the public to grasp, I think. When you hear that someone signed a confession, that's, lock the door and throw away the key time. And as I said, when I first saw the confession, I had the difficult task of telling Duran's grandmother that I thought that he was guilty. It's only on further study that I realized otherwise. 20% of the cases where someone is exonerated and found that they were wrongfully convicted, 20% of those cases involve false confessions. Other things are, jailhouse snitches, prosecutorial misconduct, police misconduct, and the fifth one, which I'm missing right now. But at least four of the five common causes found in wrongful convictions apply in this case. So it's a case that screams out for review, and I think a system that opens up opportunities for review like the one in North Carolina would be appropriate here in Pennsylvania.
For more information about the Duran Cox case, as well as a view of a reenactment of what happened the night of the shooting, you can visit the website at daroncox.org.
For more on local news, you can visit pittsburgh.indymedia.org. You're listening to Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of news overlooked by the corporate media. We turn now to news from other independent media sources around the world.
The Shell to Sea campaign has heated up again on the west coast of Ireland as local and international farmers, fishers, and environmental activists work to prevent Shell Oil from building a natural gas pipeline and refinery in County Mayo. Rust Belt has been covering this ongoing struggle for the past 2 years. Recent developments involve attempts by Shell to Sea to shut down work at the pipeline landfall site on Glengad Beach. The refinery at Ballinaboy is approximately half finished, and the well at sea is complete. Shell still does not have permission to build a pipeline connecting the two. In spite of this, construction continues on the refinery, and they have begun work on the offshore sections of the pipeline. The world's largest pipe-laying ship, the Soltaire, arrived in the area last week. It was met by the Shell to Sea flotilla, a ragtag bunch of 10 kayaks and dinghies. In response to the delays caused by Shell to Sea, the Irish Navy and Shell Security Forces sent 2 warships and 12 other vessels to patrol the bay. Irish police have made a number of arrests during the ongoing protests against the Corrib Gas Project, including 8 arrests made on Thursday, September 4th. All but one of the arrestees was released within a few hours. Police have been reluctant to press serious charges against protesters since the 2005 arrest and jailing of the Rossport Five, which galvanized support for the Shell to Sea campaign across Ireland. Dramatic images of the Navy vessels and the Shell to Sea flotilla can be seen at www.corribsos.org, and more coverage of the ongoing story can be read at the Ireland Indie Media site, www.indiemedia.ie.
Radio Roots brings us this radical history lesson for September 7th.
People! People, the time's come.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, September 7th in 1943, a group of 987 Dutch Jews were transported to Auschwitz, one of the Nazis' many concentration camps. During the Holocaust, over 2 million people were killed in Auschwitz alone. The majority were killed in gas chambers, but many also died from starvation, forced labor, disease, individual executions, and so-called medical experiments. In addition to 6 million Jews, the Nazis also murdered millions of non-Jewish people, including Soviet prisoners of war, political prisoners, Jehovah's Witnesses, people of color, gypsies, gay people, mentally ill people, and physically disabled people. Adolf Hitler was determined to purify this so-called Aryan race by slaughtering every person who didn't fit the bill. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Out of the 800-plus arrests made by the Minneapolis-St. Paul police at this year's Republican National Convention, most arrestees were charged with a citation for probable cause to riot. However, a select few, including members of the RNC Welcoming Committee, have been charged with conspiracy to riot in lieu of terrorism. Bob Fletcher, the local Ramsey County Sheriff, describes the group as, quote, a criminal enterprise made up of 35 anarchists who are intent on committing anarchy before and during the Republican National Convention. These acts include tactics to blockade and disable delegate buses, breaching venue security, and injuring police officers, end quote. Ramsey also says, quote, they have recruited assistance in their criminal conspiracy from other anarchist groups throughout the country, end quote. And, quote, in their plans and actions, they have exhibited a blatant disregard for the law and the safety of others, end quote. Rust Belt Radio spoke to Pepe, a local Pittsburgher and a six-year resident of Bloomfield, who was among at least 30 other local residents at the RNC protest. Pepe spent some time with the RNC Welcoming Committee, and he paints a different picture of what they are and what their goals are.
The RNC Welcoming Committee, in addition to the sectors, they provided a physical space, a convergence space, where groups and individuals can come, you know, as a welcoming center, like welcome to the Twin Cities. Like these, you know, it's in a place where you can meet other protesters, other demonstrators. You know, it was a place where you can get medic training. It was a space where you can get legal training. There's different legal collectives. Cold Snap Legal Collective was a great, great asset to the community while I was there. The framework that the RNC Welcoming Committee developed, you know, was a little over a year in planning. It was pretty broad. It was just saying, hey, come to our cities, come to the Twin Cities, and you can plug in on many different levels. There's sectors that you can be a part of, or there's different working groups like medics or legal support or any number of ways that you can help to disrupt the convention and to make it, you know, a supportive environment for demonstrators.
Pepe and those he was staying with were personally affected by the police in St. Paul.
The house you're staying in had been raided.
Yeah, I arrived on Friday and Friday evening and slept over a friend of a friend's house. Found any housing I could. Housing was, you know, it was a bit hard to find housing. I ended up, you know, sleeping over that night and waking up to the house being raided. Mainly by the sheriff's department of Minneapolis and St. Paul. There's two different sheriff's departments, but essentially they worked in conjunction and together along with the FBI. It was early in the morning. I was sleeping in a sleeping bag just on the couch at this house, along with a number of other individuals. I wake up to, you know, a big loud smashing through the door and police search warrant screaming, followed by SWAT team members with automatic rifles or semi-automatic rifles coming in, throwing everyone to the ground, zip tying their hands behind their back with one-way plastic cuffs, cutting off circulation, followed by them just dragging people and stepping on them, going up through every floor of the house and arrest, detaining everyone they saw. They did have a search warrant. It was presented after they were done with their raid. They presented the search warrant to the National Lawyers Guild, who was on site. So a search warrant was presented. The search warrant detailed a lot of items that are very common in a lot of American households, such as glass bottles, computers, cameras, cell phones, duct tape, really anything that could potentially be used for anything, you know, a destructive device. Really, whatever they felt like taking is what they grabbed. it's very broad, it's very vague, it's not specific in the least. They just wanted to, essentially, they just wanted to come in, smash, show their force, and make people scared. It was just a scare tactic. It really didn't have any legal precedence. It wasn't like it was this great big scheme to uncover this huge plot. It was, we're going to bust down these doors, and we're going to scare these people.
And how do they know whose houses to ransack and whose to raid? They just pick one?
You know, I wish there was a sheriff here, you know, or someone to tell me that. I don't know how they chose which house. I know there's houses like the Food Not Bombs house, you know, kids just giving food to homeless individuals, anybody that wants some. A number of houses were raided, and it's very unclear of which houses and why. You know, it's not like you're told that information. We very well could have been RNC supporters. We could have been, and we were. We really were just people from around the country that wanted to protest the RNC, and we had different goals, different aims, different means. We're just friends. It was just a positive environment. It wasn't a specific target. That's the beauty of it, is what they see, is that it's anybody. And you're in at these big summits and conventions, everybody's a suspect and everybody's a target.
So really, they just came in, scared you, and then left.
Essentially, that's what happened at our house. Other houses, people were arrested, but that was their main tactic.
So do you think they were looking for people who had an affiliation with this Republican National Convention Welcoming Committee?
Assumingly so. Yeah, actually, yes, they were looking for people that were affiliated with RNC Welcoming Committee, because there was a number of names on the search warrant that they were looking for, key individuals, or so they say, key individuals, who they wanted to arrest on, I guess, conspiracy charges. They didn't find anybody at the house I was at.
And they never gave you any reason for why they were searching the house? There was no explanation?
There's never an explanation. There's never an explanation. Assumingly so, they can't provide one, but more so, they don't have to. That's just what the police do. They don't have to provide explanation or held accountable for their actions.
Pepe and others like him were lucky enough to only be detained by the police during their raids. Others in the RNC Welcoming Committee were not so fortunate. According to Pepe, they faced severe sentences.
And what are some of these severe sentences that these people at the RNC Welcoming Committee are facing?
Severe sentencing would be decades in jail. Literally years and years in prison is what they're facing. Just on these conspiracy charges. A conspiracy charge is one in which you haven't actually committed any crime, mm-hmm. except a thought crime. Mm-hmm. And it's based upon evidence, I assume, it's based upon evidence from this paid informant who knowingly, it's very well known now that he fabricated a lot of the evidence.
Did you see any of the arrests by police of either the RNC Welcoming Committee protesters or other protesters in general? And can you give me an idea what that was like?
There was... arrests were happening all around me at all times. At many a points, I felt as like I was near arrest just for walking down the street. Or just existing in the Twin Cities made you susceptible to arrest. Or at the very least, detainment. At the very least, you were getting stopped and ID checked.
In closing the Rust Belt Radio interview with Pepe, he shares his perspective on his experiences at the Republican National Convention as a whole, remaining positive about the overall impact of the protests.
And despite of all this, I still feel individually successful, and as a large, you know, at large with the movement, I think we were successful in despite of all the repressive tactics. We were able to fulfill our desires, a small percentage of it at least.
Another example of the RNC's treatment of outsiders comes in the form of the Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul. Despite receiving more primary delegates than either Rudy Giuliani or Fred Thompson, Paul has been shunned by the Republican Party. In response, Ron Paul organized his own counterconvention in Minneapolis, calling it the Rally for the Republic. He attracted thousands of supporters who praised him vigorously, calling him St. Paul. According to Stephen Dubner of the New York Times, the Paul convention, quote, felt like a celebration. Although Ron Paul received over 29 delegates in the primary, he was not invited to speak at the RNC. Fellow primary contenders Rudy Giuliani and Fred Thompson both spoke at the convention. Paul's views on many issues diverge from the Republican Party line, most notably in his strong opposition to the war in Iraq. Perhaps the most exclusionary behavior of the RNC towards Ron Paul is their handling of the delegate vote count. Several states, including Alaska, Oregon, Washington, and West Virginia, cast a portion of their votes for Ron Paul. None of these votes were repeated out loud by the secretary and thus were not recorded by the chair. According to Drew Ivers, Paul's delegate coordinator, quote, there were several discrepancies. The RNC was roughshod, a little careless. They weren't as respectful as they could have been. I don't think that's very professional, and it's not a good reflection.
You're listening to Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of news from the grassroots. Since the start of the war in Iraq in 2002, the U.S. military has had a difficult time finding new recruits to fill the ranks of the Army, Navy, Marines, and other military positions. The growing unpopularity and disastrous state of the invasions into Iraq and Afghanistan bring additional challenges to recruiters. As a result, the military has resorted to tactics such as lowering quotas for the number of recruits and lowering the academic standards for those interested in joining the armed forces. According to an article by Slate magazine, statistics show that the percentage of new Army recruits with high school diplomas dropped from 94% in 2003 to 83.5% in 2005. This number fell to 70.7% in 2007, ultimately a 24% decrease of recruits with high school diplomas between 2003 to 2007. In addition to recruiting fewer individuals with a high school diploma, the Army is now signing up more recruits who score among the lowest levels of the Army's aptitude tests. Previously, a regulation existed prohibiting no more than 2% of all recruits to come from Category 4. Category 4 represents applicants who score in the 10th to 30th percentile on the aptitude tests. In 2004, just 0.6% of new soldiers scored so low. In 2005, the Army raised the cap to 4%. According to new statistics for 2007, the Army has exceeded that limit, as 4.1% of new recruits were Category 4. In addition to lowering academic standards, the U.S. Army and Marine Corps are now recruiting greater numbers of convicted felons. Charges against the new recruits include armed robbery, rape, sexual abuse, and drug possession. With all the challenges facing military recruiters today, new innovative techniques for recruitment have to be developed. Foreseeing this decline in enlistment, Lieutenant Colonel Casey Wardinsky of the West Point Military Academy came up with the idea to target new recruits, or children, through online video game technologies. Out of this idea was born America's Army, the official game of the U.S. Army. First released on July 4, 2002, the game is designed to provide players with Army experiences similar to that of a new recruit. The game is said to familiarize players with soldier values and give technical experience in basic training, weapons, and combat operations. The Army spent $6 million to develop the game at the Modeling, Virtual Environments, and Simulation Institute. Later in 2004, the development of the game was handed over to private gaming and software companies for adaptation to console formats. America's Army thus became available for Xbox, cell phone, as well as internet use. In addition to being available in multiple formats, America's Army is brought in person to schools, fairs, and gaming tournaments to further target youth. Prizes and lifelike weapons are present at the events as added attractions. Since its release, America's Army has been criticized as a propaganda recruitment tool that targets children ages 13 to 17. Critics state that this game only addresses the technological, not moral issues of warfare, thus providing a skewed view of reality to impressionable youth. 6 years after the release of the game, activists are now targeting the private software companies that profit from contracts with the U.S. Army. Direct Action to Stop the War, a network of anti-war groups and activists in San Francisco, are leading this campaign. Direct Action to Stop the War was formed in 2002 in anticipation of the U.S. government's invasion into Iraq. Once the war officially started, DASW helped to organize a coordination of 20,000-plus activists, which shut down San Francisco for a day. This action resulted in over 2,000 arrests. Newly reformed in 2007, Direct Action to Stop the War are working to target war profiteers based in the Bay Area. Rust Belt Radio spoke with activist Michael Reagan of the group. He first described the origins of the America's Army game.
The Army tries to pass it off as a video game, but really it's a military training and recruitment tool that the Army uses to target young, you know, high school age and younger audiences to sort of propagandize an Army career, to show them what military life is like and to get them to enlist. The game started way back in 1999. It was the idea of Colonel Casey Wardinsky, who was a professor at West Point. He was involved in the Army's Office of Manpower, and for two consecutive years, the military had missed its recruiting target quotas, its goals for 97 and 98, and the Army was looking for ways to up those numbers to meet their quotas again. Wardinsky thought that one way to sort of get into kids' consciousness and to get the Army into sort of the mass culture and sort of video game youth culture was to create this video game, America's Army, that would be free for downloads or available to be picked up from recruiting stations. So the Army spent the next couple years developing the game. It was developed at the Modeling Virtual Environments and Simulation Institute in Monterey, California, which previously had done work creating sort of tactical training and simulation for actual soldiers. So it was converted to do this video game programming as part of a recruitment program. And eventually in 2002, on July 4th, in fact, 2002, the Army released the first version of America's Army video game.
In its six-year history, America's Army has been released in approximately 20 different versions. Michael of Direct Action to Stop the War talks more about the history and popularity of the game.
There are actually several different versions. There are many versions, but it sort of came out in two stages. The first one was 2002. It was available just for home computers, for PC use, and to be played online with teams of other players as you sort of, you know, fight each other. That version was extremely popular. It became one of the top 10 online games of all time. Currently, it has over 9.5 million registered users on the America's Army website and about 30,000 players every day. And this, it sort of took off more than what the Army expected, but the Army's also promoted it through, you know, area tournaments where they invite high school kids to come in and play and with against other local groups and things like that. Then in 2005 was the release of the next version, which is the version for the console system, so things like the Xbox and other types of, you know, cell phones and all kinds of things like that. And that, I don't know exactly how popular those versions have been. But the online version, which is the main version that the Army is interested in, the PC version, has been extremely popular.
America's Army is also said to be popular due to its realistic features and lifelike experiences. Michael, however, argues that some key aspects of warfare are missing from the game.
The Army and the video game companies that worked on developing the game claim it's extremely realistic. That's one of its main selling points, in fact, is that it's the officially recognized U.S. Army game, that it had extensive work between game developers and actual Army personnel, like weapons specialists and things like that, to get every detail of the game right. So, you know, weapon functions are what real soldiers use in combat, and missions have been based on actual combat experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the experience of a player is supposed to mimic the actual recruitment process for a real soldier. So when a player starts playing, they can't go straight into combat missions. They have to go through a period of basic training and boot camp where they go to, you know, firing ranges and have target practice, they learn military professional codes, they have a drill sergeant and all of that stuff. Then once they complete that stage of the game, then they can go on to actual combat missions where they fight in these, you know, simulations of Middle Eastern cities against so-called, you know, insurgents or terrorists or things like that. The problem is that the army is really portraying only one side of combat, that this portrayal is really, it's a very sanitized version of what actual military experience is like, and it's obviously devoid of any sort of real emotional experiences that soldiers go through. So, for example, a lot of the violence in the game is sanitized. They took out sort of the blood and gore and dismemberment and all the things that we associate, you know, not only with other violent video games, but with real warfare, with real combat. So they took all of that stuff out to make the fighting look fun and exciting. And, you know, when soldiers are shot, they don't really get bloody. They're just what they look like to me is puffs of red smoke. You know, it's not really a bloody endeavor. And then you can also further sanitize the game. There are these parental controls that they put in where if players are shot, there's absolutely no blood simulation at all. And when a player is killed, instead of, you know, falling over and is dead, they just sort of sit down. They're immobile. They can no longer move. And the realism was also, you know, toned down in the types of missions that the Army chose to include in this game. So, you know, soldiers are combat infantry soldiers. They can run around and shoot people, but they don't have to deal with the effects of any of that. So, you know, you can't be a military chaplain and have to counsel someone who has post-traumatic stress syndrome for being in the, you know, these really violent and horrific combat situations. Or you can't be a military officer who has to inform a family that they've lost a son or a daughter. And so those types of, you know, real soldiers' experiences aren't included in the game.
Although America's Army is played by millions of people, its effectiveness as a recruiting tool is unconfirmed. More from Michael.
There haven't been any actual studies, surveys of the effects of the game. The Army has done informal surveys and interviews with recruits at Fort Benning, Georgia, where they asked them, you know, the influence of the game, if they played it at all. I think something like 60% of new recruits had said they played the game at least 3 or 4 times a week as recruits, and 4 in 100 recruits said they joined the Army explicitly because of America's Army. Now, I think the reason the Army hasn't done any extensive research on this is because we're just now coming to the point in 2008 when they can do that type of research. The game was released in 2002, so people who were 13 in 2002 were 18 in 2007 and could enlist for the first time. So those studies, I imagine, are going on right now.
Direct Action to Stop the War's campaign against software companies was launched at the end of this past July. Michael Reagan of the group talks about the campaign strategies.
We decided to take on the America's Army video game because there's been a lot of counter-recruitment work here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and there's a lot of really exciting and good stuff going on, stuff challenging the Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps in middle schools and high schools in San Francisco, and truth in recruiting movements with the Iraq Veterans Against the War and things like that. But no one had really been talking about this game. And we thought it was pretty dangerous, not only because it's, you know, directly trying to recruit kids, youth. I mean, 13-year-olds, that's pretty young. But it's also trying to shape cultural perceptions about the U.S. Army and military service in general. It's part of a broader propaganda program of the U.S. Army that includes movies and TV shows and things like that. But this is really targeted at an audience of people who may be more susceptible to that sort of propaganda, who may not have the experience on the game programmers who are profiting from making this game, because the Army, its first version was developed through the Army itself, through a development program within the Army, but later versions were contracted out to private companies for private profit. And we felt that that was just really over the top. That was really obscene, that these companies were trying to profit from recruiting, you know, 13, 14, and 15-year-olds. And so, and it, as it turned out, there were a lot of companies that were based in the San Francisco Bay Area who had worked on the game. So companies like Gameloft, Ubisoft, Secret Level, DCS, and others who had worked directly developing the game were in Emeryville in San Francisco. And that sort of gave us an opportunity to say, you know what, the Bay Area is an anti-war area, San Francisco is an anti-war district, and, you know, we're not happy having, you know, military recruiters and people profiting from military recruitment operate here. And what these companies should do, if they're really companies of conscience, is cancel their contracts with the U.S. Army, end their contracts, and not work on any further versions of the game.
Finally, Michael of Direct Action to Stop the War discussed ways the public can get involved in this effort.
People can go to our website, actagainstwar.net, and there's information on the game, and we do have a letter-writing campaign, so you can download a letter, sign it, and send it off to Ubisoft, which is the executive publisher based here in San Francisco. Other than that, you know, there are also tours. The Army has what it calls the Virtual Army Experience, which is this huge tour bus that has tournament players that go to state fairs and, you know, other sort of public events like that and try to get kids to come in and play this game. So, unfortunately, they're not coming to California anytime soon, but they are all over the Midwest. They're in Kentucky and Indiana and Illinois. And so folks out that way can look up that schedule online, can get in contact with us, and, you know, we can talk about how to demonstrate against the presence of those recruiters at these fairs.
You've been listening to Michael Reagan of San Francisco-based Direct Action to Stop the War. We'll be back after this break. Jim and John Army, 'cause you had no place to go. There ain't nobody hiring here since I'm jousing down to Mexico. Reckon that learning silver trade made me see the world. Moved to the city someday, married a black-haired girl. Somebody somewhere had none of the plan. Now he's got a rifle in his hand, rolling in a bag, then wondering how he got this far.
That was Rich Man's War by Steve Earle. On September 2nd, members of the local human rights group gathered outside the office of the Allegheny County District Attorney, Stephen Zappala. Members from the Black and White Reunion and the Black Political Empowerment Project, BPEP, the Pittsburgh branch of the NAACP, One Hood, and Stop Taser Abuse Today held a press conference in response to the death of Andre Thomas and the questionable recent taserings of Jason Schmidt and Sean Hicks. On August 5th, Andre Thomas died shortly after being tasered three times by Swissvale police officers. Taser use and police brutality in the case of Andre Thomas caused public outrage. Yet 3 weeks later, Jason Schmidt was tasered four times by police officers in Brighton Heights, causing an immediate hospitalization. The same day, the North Braddock Borough settled for a $100,000 suit brought by Sean Hicks, a man who was tased three times by police, who entered his house unannounced last year. At the press conference, other Allegheny County taser victims told their stories. Chris Kaysen speaks about his experience with the Homestead Police Department.
I'm walking down the street with a steak hoagie. Police officer jumps out on me, accuses me of having an open container. I say, no, I don't have an open container. He says, yes, you do. I'm arguing with the guy. I got my hands up in the air like this. They dispatch a taser, 50,000 volts. They don't hit me once. They hit me twice while I was standing. And they hit me again when I fell to the ground. And I have witnesses. I have camera footage to back the whole thing up. No gun on me, no drugs on me. I was charged with criminal mischief. I was charged with terroristic threats. And these are charges they chopped up to justify the use of the taser. I talked to the officer in charge, Officer Winterba, James Winterba, at the preliminary hearing. I said, you know, that was a steak hoagie in the bag. This is what I told him. You know what he told me? He said, yes, we found that out later. So, you know, what we have is a situation where the police are out of control. They're using the tasers and they're using them without reason.
Tim Stevens, president of the Black Political Empowerment Project, BPEP, comments on the issue.
I can say this as when I was president of the NAACP for 10 years, a few years ago, I was actually one of those that advocated the use of tasers because we had so many incidents when black men particularly were being killed at the hands of police under questionable circumstances. And at the time, the taser was a relatively new idea across the country. And some of us actually advocated the use of the tasers because our hope was that if tasered, the individual in question, who may or may not be guilty of anything, would at least be still alive. And I think what's happened in these recent reports that Ms. Taylor and the others have brought to our collective attention is that somewhere along the line, there seems to be an absence of sufficient and proper training. There seems to be an absence of the sensitivity of how dangerous the taser can be. The taser, and I pretty strongly advocated at the time, our hope was that no one would die from the taser. But if the police felt they needed to arrest someone, they could do so, but do so safely. There would be a temporary inconvenience to the body in terms of pain, and the person could be arrested in a relatively calm fashion, and then the legal system would take its course from that moment. What has begun to happen with the cases while I was away, I just learned of this recent incident while I was away, a gentleman in a coma this past week. That is not what I envisioned as an ACP president when I supported the idea of tasers. It was to bring people into custody in as safe a fashion as possible. And our hope was that the non-use of the gun would remove the possibility of death. And so somewhere, I'm hopeful that the DA's call for this committee, that he will move expeditiously, like yesterday, and pull this together so that an immediate assessment can take place and a policy resolved, and the training of all the municipalities in Allegheny County, immediate training and upgrade of that training, so that we have how many police departments in Allegheny County?
100.
We have all these municipalities and all these police departments, many of which have few trained police officers in terms of a high level professionalism. And they all must be trained on the use of the taser, the limitations of it, and the care they must take, particularly these instances where people are ill, or in his case, he's carrying something that he's eating.
Beth Pittinger, the executive director of the Citizens Police Review Board, describes the current standards and trainings regarding taser use in Allegheny County. Her explanations is followed by comments by David Myron of Stop Taser Abuse Today and Celeste Taylor, the vice president of BPEP.
We share the concerns, many of the generalized concerns that have been expressed here, and we also are looking at how do we certify our police officers in the Commonwealth. And some of what we heard was the control of training and the competence of officers who are utilizing taser in the field. And the board is looking at the standardization of those performance competencies. And we're looking to the Municipal Police Officers Education and Training Commission, which is the Commonwealth's agency responsible for certifying all police and for establishing the basic core curriculum that all police officers must demonstrate their competence to, and then 16 hours annually of in-service. So we're looking to them, hopefully, that they can look at this issue from a statewide perspective, from all the municipal police agencies operating and using TASER, and establish some standards that every officer would have to meet before they were certified to carry and use a taser in their law enforcement duties.
Are there standards currently?
Oh yeah, there are, but they're not standardized in the state. There's not a state standard that has to be met. Each municipal police agency can establish their own. And here in the city of Pittsburgh, there are training standards that they do have to demonstrate a proficiency before they're permitted to carry a taser on duty.
Are you satisfied that the Pittsburgh police officers are acting appropriately with their taser use? And well, let me ask you that first.
I think with any use of force by law enforcement, you are going to have concerns about sometimes there being an abuse of power, an abuse of discretion. And those instances we do look into on an individual basis to determine whether that use of force was appropriate, if it was a sadistic use of force, if it was used for some reason other than that which was reasonably necessary under the circumstances. The use of taser in the city of Pittsburgh, I can tell you that from the best practices published throughout law enforcement right now, the city of Pittsburgh's policies and procedures do comply to those standards. So they're not deficient there.
Do you all feel those standards are adequate?
No. No? Well, what Beth's comment, you know, fails to take into account is, once again, the lack of independent studies in terms of medical investigations into taser abuse. The studies that she may be referring to are, again, traced back either to those that have been funded directly by Taser or those that have, you know, been funded by law enforcement agencies. Of course, law enforcement agencies are going to come to some, you know, quote-unquote best practices, but when you talk about a device that can be easily used for the purpose of pain compliance that leaves very few marks, that lends itself open to abuse, whatever those best practices are. And that's, again, what we're seeing in the case of tasers. What they are in fact, an easily accessible torture toy that is used on people, you know, who simply fail to comply with verbal commands.
And we're talking about incident by incident. These are real people. Who do we want to talk about? Andre Thomas, Schmidt, who else? You have to go incident by incident. And if those police officers are abusing their use of power, then they got to be dealt with.
So do you feel the problem is that the standards are not appropriate, or the problem is that the police officers don't carry out the standards?
Both. And it varies.
Well, and it's, you know, it's part of a bigger problem of police brutality in this country, you know, which has been well documented by the Stolen Lives Project, by the Human Rights Watch, by Amnesty International. Tasers just exacerbates that pre-existing problem of police violence, which is directed largely at, you know, people of color.
On August 26th, District Attorney Steven Zappala and Medical Examiner Cara Williams announced that they would form a working group to study the weapons use by county police. The group will include medical professionals and law enforcement personnel. The human rights groups at the press conference demand that the DA committee, quote, has access to the factual information about taser and the use of force policies, invites residents and activists to participate, and includes mental health and law enforcement professionals with expertise in appropriate responses to individuals in distress, unquote. In addition, the groups call for a countywide moratorium on the use of tasers until the DA committee has completed its study and released its findings. David Myron of Stop Taser Abuse Today.
The district attorney has formed a committee to investigate the taser use, the policies, and their safety. Well, meanwhile, the policies continue, and they're going to be the tasers are going to continue to be used. That's backwards. Rather than have, you know, the use continue, they should put an immediate moratorium on the use of tasers while they do the investigation. Consider the example of a drug with the FDA, with the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA does not let a drug out in the public unless there's proven effectiveness and there's enough knowledge about its toxicity, and there are clear guidelines for use. In the case of tasers, we don't know about their toxicity, we don't know enough about their effectiveness, and we certainly don't have any clear guidelines for use. So the committee itself is also something that's very suspect. You know, according to reports in the original report that I saw in Channel 11's story where the news first broke, you know, it says, quote unquote, law enforcement experts and other medical experts. You know, those two categories most likely will fail to include the representation from the community, like people like Paradise Gray or Celeste Taylor, or people like, you know, Vic Waltuck from the ACLU and others, you know, who have a more robust understanding of the context in which police abuse takes place. So, you know, tasers is also, the Taser Committee is not just about tasers itself. It's about, you know, the context in which tasers are meant to be this supposedly less lethal alternative to firearms.
Chris Kaysen concludes with his demands for the District Attorney's Committee.
I demand that the police be held accountable for their actions. There's no system of checks and balances. Right now, you know, a group of police officers can do anything they want to you, you know, and they, what they do is they make up stories, they manufacture charges, and they get away with it because they stick together. They're going to go to court, and they're going to agree, and they're going to back one another up. So I demand that somebody come up with some system to hold these police accountable for their actions.
For more information, go to www.stoptasers.org. Also on September 20th, Pittsburgh Against Torture is holding a conference to address the many issues regarding torture. Stay tuned to our event calendar for details.
And now we present the Indie Media calendar of events. Thursday, September 11th, Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures welcomes acclaimed writers Francisco Goldman and Horacio Castellanos Moya for an evening of readings examining the impact of the murder of Guatemala's Bishop Juan Gerardi Conedera through separate works of fiction and nonfiction. Bishop Conedera was a Roman Catholic human rights advocate killed in 1998, 2 days after the publication of his four-volume report on abuses that took place during Guatemala's 36-year war. This event will be held from 7:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the New Hazlett Theater, located on the north side. Call 412-622-8866 for tickets or visit pittsburghlectures.org to order tickets online. Saturday, September 13th, from noon to 1 p.m., the Project to End Human Trafficking will host an information and training seminar at Carlo University's Antonian Room, number 502. These seminars are held the second Saturday of every month. RSVP by the Wednesday before to S. Moeller at endhumantrafficking.org. That's S-M-O-H-L-E-R at endhumantrafficking.org. And Saturday, September 20th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., an all-day conference will be held entitled Talking About Torture, How Can We Learn to Speak About the Unspeakable? This event will take place at the First Unitarian Church, located on Ellsworth and Moorwood Streets in Shadyside, and will feature a panel and presentation by Hector Aristizabal, a torture survivor from Colombia, and a psychologist who works through the theater of the oppressed. Contact 412-371-3607 or info at pittsburghagainsttorture.org for more information.
Thanks for tuning in to Rust Belt Radio here on WRCT Pittsburgh, WPTS Pittsburgh, WNJR Washington, WVJW Benwood, and WIUP Indiana. Our hosts this week are Diana Ander, Carlin Christie, and Colleen Halley, with contributions from Carlin Christie, Jessica McPherson, Colleen Halley, Helen Gerdhart, Diane Ardor, Juliana Strickland, John Hyman, and Carly Dobbins-Buckland, and Lizzie Anderson. This week's show is produced by Phil Cresswell. Special thanks to all of our host producers and contributors.
And an extra special thanks to Diane Amdor, longtime Rust Belt contributor who is visiting us today all the way from the Midwest. Hi, Diane. You can get involved with Rust Belt Radio. To contact us or send us your comments, email radio at indypgh.org. All of our shows are available for download or podcast on our website at radio.indypgh.org. And this show can be heard again Tuesday morning on WRCT at 9 a.m. after Democracy Now! Tune in next week at this time for another edition of Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of news from the grassroots.